ici Matt Track, vous écoutez CKUT 90.3 FM.
What's up, good people? To those of you listening wherever, whenever, whatever time it is, good morning, good evening, and good night. You are locked into another Tuesday evening with Soul Perspectives right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Soul P has been on the air since 1994. We bring you all the topics, the guests, the ups and downs, the highs and the lows of the black community here in Montreal, across Canada, and internationally. We have a beautiful evening of music and discussion lined up for you tonight. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives right here on CKUT 90.3 on your FM dial.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Young, black, wild, and free, naked in a limousine. Riding through the hood real slow, I love it when I smell the trees. I just wanna party hard, sex in a swimming pool.
Yes, we're back. It's another Tuesday evening, and you are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson, and my guest this evening is no stranger to Soul P, no stranger to Montreal. Her name is Warona Setsuaelo, and she is a storyteller, mother, and activist. Since moving to Jojage, Montreal, 12 years ago, Warona has immersed herself in the theater community both locally and nationally. Apart from performing with several theater companies in Montreal, such as Tisridonia, Repercussion Theater, Geordie Theater, Black Theater Workshop, The Siegel Center, Table d'Hôte, and Scapegoat Carnival, she has performed in Toronto at the Tarragon Theater, as well as the Royal Manitoba Theater Company in Winnipeg, and the Belfry in Victoria. Her credits also include Death Wish, The Disappearance, 1912, Quantico, The Detectives, Fatal Vows, as well as several video games, including Assassin's Creed Origins, The District, John Clancy's Ghost Recon, most recently Far Cry 6. She also sat on the board of ELAN, English Language Arts Network, 2015 to 2017, and she is currently the coordinator of the Artist Mentorship Program at Black Theatre Workshop, but recently stepped down as Vice President of the Quebec Drama Federation's board. Warona, welcome back. It's been a long time since we've had you on Soul P. It's a pleasure to have you back. We've known each other for quite a few years. So I'm
a long time.
To...
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. So basically, you know, every show we like to check in with our guests and see how they're doing, because, you know, the past 2 years have been quite tumultuous, to put it mildly.
To say the least.
And, you know, you work in a theater company, and theater... And people is like paramount. Like, You can't have theater without having people. It's not like TV. And even with TV, you have to have people around. There's people on screen. There's people behind the scenes. There's a lot of people involved. So just wanted to see how did the pandemic affect you both personally and professionally? How was that when that stuff hit?
So when the pandemic hit, I had about, I think, 4 shows lined up to do that year. Like, I had a show that I was starting rehearsal for, like, literally weeks after the pandemic started, you know, like in April, I think, of 2020. I was supposed to do a show that summer. I was supposed to do a show that spring and another one. Anyway, the point is that I had a bunch of stuff. Obviously, it all got canceled, which was tough. And, you know, for the first while, it was a little bit scary. I do have a position at Black Theater Workshop, but at the end of the day, it's a part-time position. You know, I have a kid, I got bills to pay, so we were all feeling it, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Some, you know, still are. But it was this really interesting balance, because on personal side, you know, like, even though I was kind of freaked out about, like, what am I going to do about work and what's going to happen, on the personal side, I am, like I mentioned, the mother of a 10-year-old child. And, you know, anybody that has kids, and definitely people that have kids, anybody that has kids like yourself, will know that it can be a lot of work. And so it kind of felt like a rest a little bit, if I can say that, you know, just because especially in that first few months, you know, the kids weren't even going to school at that point. So I didn't have to wake up super early and, you know, fight with a child to come out of bed and all that. And, you know, all the rushing around trying to get home before this, or trying to pick up somebody to go do this. It's a lot of running around.
Right.
So there was like a certain part where I actually just got more sleep, honestly, where I was kind of like, oh, well, this is something I didn't expect from all of this. But all that to say, you know, I'm lucky enough to work in an industry, not necessarily theater, but I work in film as well, and I work in video games and voice work and stuff like that. And so that kind of kept chugging. And we just had to fashion, you know, I was just trying to look for all the silver linings in terms of how we can do the work. And yes, you need people to do theater, absolutely, but, you know, not all theater is for an immediate audience. There's a lot of development that can happen. There's a lot of fostering and mentorship that can still happen while we're not actually producing shows. So it sort of forced me to be more creative about the work that I do, and to really think about, what does theater actually mean to me? Mm-hmm. You know, is it all about that audience being in there? And then what does that mean? Like, that felt a bit ego-ish, or like the ego was involved a little too much there. So it forced me to kind of unpack some of that, to be like, what is theater? And also just the fact that, you know, if I am one of the artists that are privileged enough to keep working during the pandemic, I really want to try to pay it forward somehow. I want all artists to be working.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's so difficult. I work a lot with younger people. So it's so difficult for people who graduated during the pandemic. I mean, come on.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? Yep. Like, that's a whole other... Anyway, so I'm really trying to create as many sort of silver linings, if I can call it that. It's more just like how to live and work more creatively, figuring out how I can still do what I want to do, or still feel like I'm doing something, not just sort of, you know, because I feel like it can be really engulfing. You know, the pandemic, it's tough. So I'm lucky enough to have certain things. So I'm trying to really keep that good momentum going, not just for me, but build it for other people, you know?
Yeah.
That's kind of how I'm rolling through this pandemic. And don't get me wrong, there are some really dark days. Let's not pretend it's all flowers and sunshine, okay? Just let's keep it all the way 100.
No, well, I like the way that you put the spin on it about, you know, being able to rest more, and that things were a bit calmer, because there's always a different side to how people take the pandemic. And you can definitely take it and go really, really dark and go into a really dark place. But you can also see the collateral benefits, I like to say sometimes, that actually occur. Like, some people get to spend more time with their children, and that's like something that they didn't realize that they were missing out on. And then
absolutely.
Because the truth of the matter is, when you have a child, out of a full 24-hour day, right, how much time do you actually spend with your child? Like,
100%.
There's two or three hours where you're, like, getting them up out of bed and getting them to school or,
uh-huh.
or to daycare or wherever they're going. And then there's the 2 to 3 hours, maybe 4 or 5, depending on what their sleep schedule is like, depending on what your work schedule is like. If you get out of work at 3 o'clock or if you get out of work at 5, you know, that...
Right.
People don't always take that into consideration, but now that there's a pandemic, you have a lot more time to spend. I mean, and this
well, that's it, right?
This is before, you know, digital school, digital schooling,
right?
Whatever
online
the term
school,
is, online
yeah.
schooling. This is before, like, people were like, "Oh, we can do this. We can get everybody on by Zoom, or as many as possible," because
yeah.
you know.
Exactly.
Digital
no, 100%.
School, online schooling came with its privileges as well. One thing,
very true,
because we interviewed teachers, and they made us very aware, because some people don't think about it. It's like having a laptop or an iPad or a desktop at home. That's second nature to most people, but there are a lot of people who they just can't afford to have.
Absolutely.
All of that
or
equipment.
They just have one, you know,
exactly.
and then if
and maybe
the parents are working from
kids.
Home, then now where does the kid come in with theirs? So absolutely, there are 100% privilege around that, or even just internet access as well, you know.
Yeah.
Not everybody has, like, unlimited internet so that everybody can be on their laptop and be online and doing virtual work, virtual school, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, no, it's still, you know, and I think that's part of... you know, my unpacking of myself during this pandemic or this time to be, like, at home with your family or is that, you know, like, really looking at my privilege. Like, you know, I'm really lucky to keep working. I'm really lucky that, you know, these sort of things are in place. Like, a lot of people lost a lot of things. Or even just, I'm lucky to be one of those people that can look on the bright side, you know, because
mm-hmm.
mental illness is real. So there are
yeah.
some people who just literally can't do that, which is why I try to fight really hard to be able to help other people in that kind of way, because
yeah.
not everybody even has the privilege of being happy or being able to see positivity. Like, that's not
yeah.
a given, you know,
because
it's,
the chemicals
it's
in their brains don't allow them to experience the positivity that can come out of different situations such as this one.
100%. Yeah.
That is, I like that. I out of all the people that we've interviewed thus far, that wasn't something that really took into consideration about, oh, you get to actually spend more time with your kid. Because, like, myself, I'm considered a essential worker. I work in a place
right.
that I, yes, there was a time period that stopped because I was on call in the beginning. So there was, like, a month of, like, limbo. No, they weren't calling us in. And then once they started calling us in, it was like, instead of calling us daily, it was like calling us for weeks at a time. It was like, okay,
oh, wow, okay.
Come in for a week, come in for a week, come in for a week. Granted,
yeah.
it was part-time,
okay.
but I was still being called in. So,
yeah,
you know, I still had to go into work and all of that stuff. And there's a lot of people I realized as I was able to, as I was commuting to work, is there's a lot of people that, okay, yeah, there's this so-called pandemic, but I don't
yeah.
have a choice. I gotta go to work.
Yeah,
you know,
100%, right?
And all those risks that they have to take,
hugely,
and
hugely. So
that
yeah,
people who can stay home—that's and work. That's another
yep.
privilege that
yep.
that you didn't anticipate. That you know you,
nope.
you don't even think about.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it's all that kind of stuff, you know, thinking about how we actually, like, live in this world, you know, like, what
and
are we actually
becoming
doing?
Like it's becoming like an episode in Black Mirror almost, where
oh, are you kidding? I swear, sometimes I'm like, do we not, I don't understand, we make all kinds of TV shows about this kind of stuff, you know, apocalyptic, blah blah blah, and all those shows have the same message, you know, community is the best way, which we know, but, like, still, we're still on this sort of capitalistic hunt. We're still trying to return to quote-unquote normal, which is a term I really don't like, because I didn't like normal. Like, normal was very difficult for me.
Right.
So, and for a lot of people. So I'm like, can we just look at this as an opportunity to change the way we do a lot of things? Like, obviously, a lot of things do not work. And yeah, exactly. What do you say when you're like, Everybody stay home. Except you, you, and you. And you're not getting paid anymore. You're not getting any more benefits. You're not getting anything. Like, it's just literally like
you're not the getting title a COVID of the essential package.
Yeah.
Oh, we know that a lot of you have to take public transit, and a lot of you have to do this and that. Okay, so here's an extra amount that we're giving you. Nope, there's no.
Yeah, exactly.
There's nothing like that.
Exactly. You know, for more PPE, so you can protect yourselves even more on public transport, blah 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 blah, or just have it like so you don't have to pay for your own, you know, PE, some kind of exemption for essential. I don't know, whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's a conversation that I hope. We are slowly learning something. I hope there are things I can see that are changing. And I just hope we really like engulf this wholeheartedly, because I do think we have this opportunity to change, you know, like, mm-hmm.
And you know, what's interesting is, as we're talking about TV shows, I was listening to a podcast with Neil deGrasse Tyson. And they were talking about horror movies, and they were talking about, they started comparing the fact that we're in a pandemic right now. We've been in a pandemic for the past 2 years, and people watching horror movies, and there's someone who's actually doing research about the effect of horror movies on human beings and the psyche and depression and One of the factors was how people who watch a lot of horror movies, especially zombie movies, so, you know, survival movies, Day of the Dead, Walking Dead, all of that, and how they felt about the pandemic. And from the research that they actually found, people who had watched more of those horror-type movies, especially ones that had to do with like apocalyptic type situations, zombies and you know, survival, they were much more psychologically prepared for it's crazy. They were much more psychologically prepared for the pandemic, and when it happened they were like, I'm ready. I got whatever I need at home and I'm prepared.
It makes sense. Like, I'm a big sci-fi fantasy person. I'm not a huge zombie person necessarily, but I watch a lot of, you know, I've watched a lot of apocalyptic stuff. And I was also one of those people that, you know, the 2 weeks before the actual official shutdown, that was like, you know, wiping off my desk and my keyboard with like spray and stuff like that. And people were laughing at me, you know, and I was asking at work, are we going to be sent home? Are we going to stay home? I sent a note to my kid's school, asking, and everyone, like, I got a note back from my kid's school, like the day before we shut down, saying, don't worry about it. If we hear of anything, we will let you know immediately. Literally the next day, they were like, okay, party done.
I love that. Party done.
You know what
everybody
I'm saying?
Go home.
So I was totally one of those people that was like, people were looking at a little bit oddly, you know, like, oh, you're being paranoid. And then it was like, boom, shut you know, down. Within a week or so.
We
so
I believe that. Lockdown. Lockdown.
No, right?
I just found it so interesting that people who consumed this type of media, because it's a lot, like, it's a lot of movies that are apocalyptic, and there's like apocalyptic surreal, so where it's like zombies and the world is gonna crack open and demons and all of that. And then there's like the real type of apocalyptic movies where it's like, they're like the most popular one that we know, it's called Outbreak, you know, where this monkey, this monkey bit somebody and then that person got sick and it was transmitted via spit, saliva, sneezing on people, coughing on people.
Right.
You know, and then I think about the movies that came out. There was one movie that came out on Prime, and it was like, it was COVID-24 or something like that. And I was like, is this really appropriate to be making this movie now? Like, I look at the advertising for it and I'm like, are you serious? We're not even done this one. And now you're freaking people out.
COVID 20, oh, like as in COVID-19, 20, 21, 22, 23.
24, something like that. It could have been 23 or 24. I don't remember.
Right, no, I get it.
But I'm like, dude, come on. Yeah,
you're like, yo, we haven't even figured this one out yet. I don't know if it's a bit too soon to be making jokes about, you know what I mean? No, but it's true. But we do this all the time, you know? There's so many movies that portray even just like, you know, parallels of capitalism and parallels of just the way the world works now and, you know, imperialism and all of that. And in every single one of those movies, you find that people, you know, they totally get it and they see who the underdog is. They totally see who the bad guy is. Like, they see it so clearly. But then in real life, you know, it just doesn't work that way. Like,
Well, I, for one, I'm very happy that, you know, people didn't wig out and, like, most of these pandemic-style movies start mashing up places, at least not here in little old Montreal, because what's the first thing that happens in a pandemic? People go crazy, they start smashing in all the stores, and, like, it's just, like, complete riot. That didn't happen. It felt so strange. It felt very surreal to experience a pandemic in real life versus the dramatization that movies normally
do.
The thing that weirded me out was, like, why is everybody buying toilet tissue? I didn't understand.
Oh, my God. Like, yeah, the toilet paper in the beginning. The
toilet paper thing, I was like, not getting that. I mean,
folks have their priorities, right?
Exactly. And having lived through hurricanes and those kind of disasters, you know, normally the things that come off of the shelf is anything that's dried or canned, that disappears from the shelf first, and water. Any bottled water is, like, unavailable.
Yes, gone.
And I was looking at the shelves, and I was just like, I don't know, there's something not right here. Like,
well, it's obviously people that have never really had to deal with proper disaster, you know what I mean? Like, they really haven't, so they just don't know
what to do.
What, you know, what to get.
Just in case you're tuning in for the first time, you are listening to Soul Perspectives, and I'm speaking to Warona Sotwaelo, who is a storyteller, a mother, and activist. And we do have to take a quick break, but we'll be back. Keep it locked here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Sexy body girls.
So put it here, baby, open your eyes and let me groove you. Got the fat groove on the real. So put it here, baby, open your eyes and let me groove you. Got the fat groove. A salt and pepper came back to the mic. It's not the end of the road. And like the boom in the bass, about to explode. I got the rhymes to keep you going like petrol. So every time you see me on the mic, you know you just can't let go. So here we go again, sexy in a twin pack. Straight from my eyes down to my back stack.
You're under my control.
No 50-50 loving without an X. Problem.
Oh, I want you deep inside.
Oh, yeah, the rude girl, she come for
so
them.
So put it here, yeah, baby, open your eyes and let me groove you. The music in my mic can move you like engine, number 9. I got the rump shaker flavor with the nasty rhyme. So if the crowd can move with me, salt and pepper say groove with me.
Groove me.
What's a girl, them sexy, man?
I need you.
For real.
Groove me.
Run it, party with him, chap.
I need you.
Straight up.
But now I'm back, busting fat rhymes and I'm here to stay. So you got to give it up like Marv Gaye.
You're under my control.
No 50-50 loving girl without an extent.
I got your heart and soul.
Them the kind of lovely girl who are from them men.
Go down and
take. There's a lot going on in the world today. See how it affects Montreal's Black and Caribbean community. Read the community contact. News, features, opinions, music reviews, cultural events, and so much more. Our voices, our perspectives, our community. published every 2 weeks. Pick it up at your favorite community spot or visit us online at our new and dynamic website, mtlcommunitycontact.com. Easy to navigate and lots to enjoy. Archived issues also on the site and available on the web. That's mtlcommunitycontact.com. Stay in contact.
Yes, 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 we're back, we're back, we're back. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson, and my guest this evening is Warona Setswaelo, who is currently the coordinator of the Artist Mentorship Program at Black Theatre Workshop, and she is a storyteller, mother, and activist. Warona, thank you so much for being here. Been having fun with the conversation so far. What a lot of people may not know about you is that you're originally from South Africa.
Mm-hmm, and Botswana.
Botswana, specifically. Mm-hmm. And you made your way... Why on earth did you come to Montreal? you're in South Africa. I would assume that, you know, that's a warm climate. You'd want to go to a climate that's more warm. So why on earth... Right? How did Montreal end up coming up
in the things places? We do for love, Kim.
Oh, like, Lord. You know, like,
I can't even pretend. It's like an age-old story. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, I'm not going to lie. I did want to move at the time. I kind of wanted something different. I had just, like, left my job at the time. And, you know, I had a degree in acting that I'd never really... used properly. So mm-hmm. Yeah, the guy I was dating at the time was here, and I thought it would just be different, you know. Like, I was like, ooh, French North America, that's interesting, because I'd lived in the States before.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, I moved quite a bit in my life, and I was just ready for another move. So right. I just took a leap, to be honest. Like, I'm not gonna lie, I didn't think about it too much at the time. I kind of just took a leap, and I wasn't even like moving here to live with him forever. I was coming to visit and see.
Right. Oh, that's how Montreal gets you.
We're
just going to come up for a week. We're going to come up for some school. And then it's like, wait a minute. Hold on. 20 years later.
Exactly. You kind of did the same thing. And you came from a warm place, too.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. But I was born here. So, like, there's a little bit of logic as to why I came back.
No, that's true. No.
You know?
It was very random. I never saw myself living in Canada. Like, sometimes I go, like, oh, my God, I live in Canada. Like, it just was not even on my
radar.
Radar of things that was going to happen in my life. I just never thought about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then here I am, so life is really funny.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you had an acting degree from the States.
Mm-hmm.
But also what a lot of people don't know, and I have the privilege of knowing, is that you were actually on television in South Africa. You had a stint on a kind of a Big Brother like television series.
Or Big Brother, the actual television series. There we go.
I didn't remember the name, so I didn't want to misspeak.
No. Yeah. Obviously, I don't know. I'm sure people know Big Brother, the TV show, the reality show. So they had South African Big Brother started, I want to say, like in 2001, I believe, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they had two seasons of it, and then they opened it up to all of Africa. And I applied from Botswana. And because I'm, you know, my dad's from Botswana, my mother's from South Africa. So I say I'm from Botswana and South Africa. But yeah, so I applied from Botswana and I got in. And so, yeah, I was on a reality show. It's almost 20 years ago now. Hey, I'm
wow.
Like, oh my goodness gracious. Yeah. But it was the first Big Brother Africa. They've had more subsequently. And it was the first time a lot of Africans, Black Africans specifically, saw themselves represented, because we were just young and, you know, full of zest. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't think the channel expected the show to be as popular as it was, but it ended up being really popular and kind of like breaking some boundaries, which was really awesome.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people had just never seen themselves represented in that way of just like fun-loving young people having a good time, like, you know, that kind of
really
thing. It was fun.
So So even though it was an African channel, there was still a lack of representation, like, in terms of young African
people. Well, the two previous seasons of Big Brother, when they just done Big Brother South Africa, they were majoritively, well, I don't even know if they were majoritively white, or they were definitely minoritively black. Like, right. there were white people, there were people of Asian descent, and mixed race people, but black people, they were in the minority. Right. So it was definitely much more what was considered a white show mm-hmm. before that. Like, I think white people made up the most in the group of people on the South African ones. Mm-hmm. And then on our one, you know, it was Big Brother Africa. They're coming from all over. And so there was a white person on ours, but it was only one white person. Wow. You know what I mean? Which is like more representative. I'm not saying they shouldn't have white people, but like, let's represent the continent for what right. it is. You know what I yeah. mean? Which is mostly, you know, black people, mm-hmm. mixed race black people. And, you know, yeah. Anyway, so they weren't expecting that kind of representation because the show was quite white before, so the audience was quite white before, mm-hmm. and they just weren't expecting black people to catch on, see what was happening on the screen, and be like, no, actually, we're interested.
Which is, it's it feels like a fallacy because it's like there's such a closed-mindedness when it comes to just historically we're talking about cinema and motion picture, just to encompass both television and cinema. It's like, there's this thing of like, oh, black people don't go to the cinema. It's like, no, black people don't go to the cinema because one, you don't let them into the cinema. Mm-hmm. You put them in nosebleeds where the cinema looks like a small thing and they can't barely see it. Two, they're not on the screen.
Yeah.
So why would I spend my hard-earned money to go in to watch a movie when I'm never there?
Yeah.
You know, or I'm always the villain, or I'm always the
exactly.
I'm always the mammy, or I'm always
just
the,
represented the Jezebel, badly. Yeah. Just like, yeah.
And even now, I still get pissed at movies that have the same archetype. So they'll have an amazing black character, right? Or let's go with a horror movie, for example. They have an amazing black character, and what they do in the first 10 minutes. First of all, the black character is the logical one who's like, we need to not split up and we right. need to not do all this stupid shit that everybody in horror movies always does. But he always gets killed first. Mm-hmm. I'm like, damn, like, really?
Still doing it.
Really? 2022 and that's where we're going? You know, and it's been a trope for a long time. So if you don't cater to the audience, you know,
then why would now the audience it's been... You know, we've seen it. It's been proven that when you do cater to the audience properly, authentically, you know, obviously we've seen it happen again and again. Black Panther, Get Out, mm-hmm. like all this stuff, you know, the Spider-Man, all these kinds mm-hmm. of things where it is not only do black people support it, but we go hard when we support yeah. stuff. And, you know, we don't play around times. When we support stuff, okay? We're going to make an outfit, a meal. There's going to be a dance with the name on it. Like, we're going to make everything for this thing. You know what I'm saying? Oh, exactly. For real. Like, it's that's how we roll, you know?
It's going to yeah. be an event, and we're going to go multiple times because...
100%.
We want to see more of that. And the only way that these big... these big corporate companies will understand that is if they get money in their pocket and they're like, mm-hmm. oh my God, highest grossing movie of 2018 was Black Panther. How many billions of dollars did we make worldwide? Oh, maybe we should do it again. And maybe we should mm-hmm. have more, you know. But when you think about it, it's like, how many billion black people are there worldwide? Like, it just makes sense. Like, China 100%. Is not the majority of the planet. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I think about South Asian characters. I'm like, you know how many millions of them motherfuckers is? Like, there's yeah. a lot of them. Why wouldn't yeah. you? And they love movies. Because,
yeah.
Because when you watch everybody their movies,
everybody
does. Their movies
everybody
are
wants
beautiful.
To be represented. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So why wouldn't you make more movies that have multiple representation? We already know that the white movies, they're going to do okay because
yeah, yeah.
there's an automatic white audience and so they're automatically going to watch. But when you have stuff of color, there's a richness there. So why not? Why not? And so you yeah. made your way from South Africa and you came to Montreal. And it's funny because you say that you left your job and you hadn't been doing much with your degree, your acting degree. But when you came to Montreal, it seems like you kind of started to move in the theater performing arts circle again.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, that's a whole other reason, excuse me, that I came here was really to pursue that acting career, like really to go hard. Like that was the other pull. And so I was very singularly focused on that when I got here, you know, and then started with volunteering. And I did a lot of volunteering. I did a lot of shows for free, a lot of volunteering in theater companies and just trying to build up a resume, you know, got an agent. At the same time, I was like applying for my paperwork because then I decided, okay, I'm going to stay. Mm-hmm. So now I'm applying to become a permanent resident. I can't even work because I have to, you know, wait until my paperwork comes through and all this kind of stuff. Right. And so, yeah, I just like spent, I think it took 2 years for me to get my permanent residency. And I just spent those 2 years like just schlepping, like just doing whatever shows I could possibly get into, any, you know, I was also like no money whatsoever. So right. Any free workshops or anything I could do for exchange, like mm-hmm. I was just trying to hustle my way into like learning more about the business, learning more about the Montreal theater scene. I also wanted to do film and television. I wanted an agent. I wanted all of it, you know? So right. I just wanted to like learn as much as possible, as quickly as possible, and try to take advantage of as much as I possibly could. Like I was really on a very singular focused
purpose. Yeah.
I really, really did, because honestly, you know, I told you I lived in the States. I went to school in Virginia Tech. I lived in Southwest Virginia for a long time. And I had a good time down there. But I, you know, I'm born and raised on the African continent. I actually had zero plans to move back to North America. Like right. I was very happy to go back home and be there, you know yeah. what I mean? And then I ended up meeting this guy and all this other stuff or whatever, but I really didn't have any plans to come back. So when I did come back, I came back on a mission of I'm gonna get this stuff done so that I can go back,
right?
You know, like right. I wasn't even still then, I wasn't really planning on staying. Obviously my life has changed a lot now and blah blah blah, blah. And you know, I've made like a life for myself. I have a child, a partner here and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I didn't come here and but I still also like, you know, I might still go back or go live somewhere else. I can't see myself honestly living in here as an old person being in the forever. Cold. I'm not gonna right. lie. But you know, things change. I might change my mind like I did now, but I just can't see it right now.
Right.
Would like to be in the warmth for my last years on this earth. But you know, and my partner just moved to Toronto. I'm probably gonna do that, you know, in the next couple of years as well. So yeah, I'm not saying that I'll never move from here, but it, you know, it ended up being like a really good fit. Like I like it here. It's been good to me. I've managed to work my way through the business enough so that, you know, I have a career now. I can say that I have the acting career that I came here to get. Yeah, I can, you know, say, knock on wood, that I have it now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not always smooth sailing, but I feel like I have a career. I'm not just hustling job to job anymore.
Absolutely.
And so and that's
then,
nice.
Then now, it seems to me that you're a bit of a masochist, because on top of the fact that you decide to move from South Africa to North America, you decide to come to Montreal, Quebec. On est au Québec ici, là.
Oh, and I don't even speak French. Oh, I don't know what I was thinking about. Well, I was unaware of some of the socio-political dynamics, but at the end
how
of the
did you
day,
maneuver
like,
that? Because like Quebec is so hardcore when it comes to French.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable sometimes. Even me as a bilingual person, I'm like, y'all need to like take a tall glass of some alcohol and chill. Because
chill
it's
out.
A little bit much. It's a little bit much.
No, it is pretty hardcore. You know, as even though I was born and raised in the African continent and I've lived in like four different African countries, but bless you, the only language I speak fluently is English. Mm-hmm. It's a long story. Mm-hmm. So I'm used to being, most of my life I've lived in countries where I don't speak whatever the language of the country is fluently. That's my norm. That's number one. And then I think when I came here, I did really want to like try to learn more French, and I wanted to, you know, like just get more proficient in French and stuff like that. And, you know, so I would always try to speak French. And I don't know if it was just luck or whatever, but for the most part, I would run into people who just thought it was cute that I was trying, people who just switched to English. Or I also realized there, especially my first couple of years, because a lot of people who would just like, because they, even though they saw that I was speaking really bad French, they would keep speaking French with me. And after a while, I realized some people just thought the only Canadian language I could speak was French, and whatever the other language I spoke wasn't English, so they wouldn't switch to English, which actually helped me learn a bit more French, you know?
Okay.
So
their prejudice worked for you.
You know, it kind of just felt like the normal sort of whatever, you know, like it is what it is. And if I run into people that are, you know, not so nice about it, like, I'm not like, you know, I can also be not so nice if you, you know, if you bring it, I can bring it too. Like I said, luckily for me, maybe it's because of where I've lived and stuff like that, that I haven't had to encounter so much of that, if I'm honest.
Right.
Like I had no idea though. I really did not know about a lot of Canadian politics or just socio, like the way people live and what's considered what. But, you know, you find these dynamics everywhere. You know what I'm saying?
It's
like,
very true.
You look at the English and the French over here, like, if this was Africa, they'd call that tribal warfare. You know what I mean? Like, that's what that is. I'm like, familiar. Like, everywhere you go, there are going to be groups of people that have different languages or different cultures within the country that can't stand each other or have issues between each other and all this other stuff. You know what I mean?
100%.
And then the English and the French busy fighting. Meanwhile, what's going on with the indigenous people? Like, it's you know, every country has its mess. And its beauties. This is what I've discovered. I've lived in 6 countries. Every single one has wonderful things that everyone should adopt. Every single one has horrible, heinous things that should be abolished from everything. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So you just kind of have to roll with it, I guess.
Well, I'm glad that it's interesting though that in most of the countries that you've lived in, like you were the minority in terms of the language that you spoke, so you kind of already had an understanding of how to navigate in a situation whereby okay, the majority of the folks are not speaking the language I'm speaking, so this is what I got to do to survive and to thrive within that situation. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. I always wonder about folks that come from places where they absolutely do not speak any French, and they come to Quebec of all places, that's so like, they can be so intense about the French. I mean, just a few years ago, there was the whole Loi 101 or something like that, Bill 101, whatever it is. And I was like sitting down at work and hearing people talk about it. And I was like, what is wrong with you people? Like, what is wrong with you? Like, we let people speak English if they want to speak English. You know, what's the big idea? I don't know. Il faut qu'on parle français, sit and da 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 da. I'm just like, that's a little bit too extreme for me. You know,
right?
I got a lot on my plate as a black man walking around in this very white country as it is already. You know,
well, that's it.
I don't want
you
to
know what I mean?
Battle.
One time I had a black person tell me to speak French. I was like, baby, that's not any of our language. Like, this is colonialism for both of us. Like, can we please not?
Let's not colonize each other.
At the end of the day, this sort of attitude I adopted was that the language I speak fluently is not my own. I've already mastered one colonial language. So don't talk to me about mastering another one. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So it is what it is. So until anyone who wants to talk to me about French, I'm going to talk to them about some kind of indigenous language. They live here. They were born here. They grew up here. They've probably lived here for generations. You don't speak an indigenous language? Okay. Well, bet. I don't speak French, and I'm not going to learn it past what I can do right now. I've been here for almost 14 years at this point. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that it's also that kind of thing where I'm just like, stop. So you're just being a complete hypocrite. Like, stop it.
Yeah.
Like, I will call you out. And also, like, I've mastered a colonial language. Have you mastered an indigenous one? No? Okay. I'll wait on you to do that, and then I'll start tackling French.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Just in case you're tuning in for the first time, you are listening to Soul Perspectives, and we are speaking to Warona Setswaelo, who came from Botswana in South Africa all the way to Montreal, and we just had a great conversation about that journey and, of course, you know, the language barriers that comes with coming and moving to Quebec. We do have to take a quick break, pay some bills, play some music. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Yes, 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 we're back, we're back, we're back. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My guest this evening is Warona Setswaelo, who is a storyteller, a mother, an activist. She came all the way from South Africa, came to the United States, got her degree in acting, went back to Botswana and South Africa, stayed there for a bit, then you know, just took a leap of faith and decided, you know what? I'm going to come to Montreal. I'm going to do my theater thing. I'm going to do my acting thing. And she mostly spoke English. Like, English is the tongue that she mastered. And in this French-speaking country, she has gotten jobs in theater, gotten jobs in the video game industry, gotten jobs in the movie industry, and she sat on the board of ELAN, English Language Arts Network, from 2015 to 2017. She was the vice president of the Quebec Drama Federation's board, And she's presently the coordinator of the Artist Mentorship Program at Black Theater Workshop. Waruna, thank you so much for sharing your story with our listeners. It is a really interesting story. I think you need to do a biopic or write a book or something, because I would definitely be one of the first buyers. one of the theater companies that both for you and myself has been very important in our lives has been Black Theater Workshop. And you've been involved with BTW for quite some time. Then you became involved more concretely. You were involved more in the performing arts section, and then you became more involved as the co-coordinator of the Artist Mentorship Program at BTW. Tell us a little bit about how you got started with BTW and how you got to being the co-coordinator of the AMP program.
Okay, like I said, when I first moved to Canada, I was not legal to work or anything like that, and I was just trying to get to know the theater landscape a little bit better, and so I was volunteering. Obviously, since I'm Black, a lot of people were pushing me in the direction of Black Theater Workshop, and I'm not one of those Black people that shy away from that kind of stuff. I was like, other Black people, fantastic, let me go meet them. So I went over there and literally just volunteered myself to volunteer, and I started like so far away from anything artistic. I was like stuffing envelopes for the general manager, like doing just like, yeah, just going over there to volunteer, but just being in the building and talking to people. You know, I got to meet the artistic director, and I got to find out more about what Black Theater Workshop does and how they do it and everything like this. And at the time, they had an after school program called Youth Works, which some people might remember, for kids, you know, teaching theater. And I was hired as and at the time it was run by Mike Payette or Tamara Brown, and Mike Payette was under her. And she hired me to be a storyteller, like teaching storytelling. Mm-hmm. So I did that for a couple of years. It was like during the summer, and, you know, some weekends during the season. So that was really great. And I got to know more about Black Theater Workshop. I auditioned for them in their generals a couple of times, like before I could even work, because I just wanted them to see. Black Theater Workshop actually ended up being Tyrone Benskin, who is artistic director then and actually acting artistic director now, but he called me and they ended up being the first professional anything to offer me a job. And I couldn't take it because I didn't have my papers yet. Right. Like I wasn't legal yet. So I remember him calling me and offering it to me. And I was so excited. And of course I said yes. And then literally 2 minutes after dropping the phone, I was like, oh wait, this is probably like a legal thing where I have to sign papers, because I've been doing so much volunteer work before so I had to call him back and tell him that I couldn't do it. It really sucked. But at the same time, I was like, oh, at least I know that I can be hired, you know, it's not outside of the realm of possibility. So it gave me, you know, it gave me some wind under my wings, basically, to keep going. Anyway, so that was before I started working at Youth Works. So then when I finally got my paperwork together and everything like that, that's when I started working at Youth Works, and did that for a few years. Then Youth Works was transformed into the Artist Mentorship Program, which is still now. And then I was hired as an acting mentor. I was your mentor, Kim. That's how we met.
2015,
when you were in AMP.
Yeah.
Hey?
2015 to 2016, yeah.
Exactly. So I did that for a couple of years. And then when the creator of the program, Mike Payette, when he left to be artistic director of Geordie, that's when I became the coordinator. And then most recently, in the last 3 or 4 years, I've been joined by Mariah Inger, also an amazing, incredible artist, activist, actor, mom. So she's joined me, and we're doing it together now. But yeah, that's pretty much my story there. And I've been there for, I guess, like as coordinator for, I guess, like 6-7 years. I think this is like my 7th year or something going into it, something like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a really rewarding job. You know, we support emerging artists, and we just want to give people actual real tangible advice and tangible platforms in order not just to showcase themselves and network themselves, but to learn more about this business, because this business is a strange business, you know, it's not.
Yeah. And there's not a lot of... how important was it? Because you said you don't shy away from getting involved in Black organizations. How important was it for you to be involved in Black Theater Workshop because of the Blackness?
Yeah, listen, man, I mean, that, like I said, if I see a Black organization, and that's not me saying every single Black organization is amazing, every organization is what it is, and, you know, there's issues and whatever, but at the end of the day, like, you know, like Issa Rae said, I'm here for, you know, I'm rooting for everybody Black, mm-hmm. like, so it doesn't mean I'm not rooting for nobody else, but, like, listen, like, right now, so yeah, if I see people that are mandated, their mandate is to support Black people, support Black stories, support Black representation. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm absolutely going to be attracted to that. The same way I'd be attracted to an organization that supported like marginalized people in general kind of thing, you know, like people that fall under several intersections. I'm one of those people. So I am very supportive of, and I do believe that for those of us who fall under, you know, oppressed in oppressed groups, that being in groups that are exclusive to us or being in organizations that are exclusive to us can be very healing. Mm-hmm. You know, you find like-minded people, you can really find comfort there. You can really learn who you are and how to work in an environment without having to code switch or, you know, deal with microaggressions, like, you know, racial microaggressions anyway, you know, but
right.
So yeah, it is really important to me. It's really important, one, to find like-minded people. And I definitely am always going to, if there is something that says a Black organization, I'm definitely going to be attracted to that, you know? Mm-hmm. Definitely going to want to be connected to it in some sort of way, yeah.
You said something interesting. You said that when you're in an organization of people that look like yourself and are mandated to support folks like yourself, one of the things that you don't have to do is you don't have to code switch. Could you tell, because that's a term that a lot of people use, could you tell us what code switching is as you understand it?
The way I understand it basically is that most people, not just Black people, but we're talking about Black people right now, have a way in which they operate, as in talk, their mannerisms and all of that when they're around, you know, we all do this, your friends, family, yeah. That kind of thing. And mm-hmm. then a different way in when they're at work. And there's a certain level of it that's just professionalism versus personal, which we all have. Mm-hmm. But there is another layer, which is cultural.
Yeah.
And when it becomes cultural, that's sort of like, because there is a, you know, when you know that this would still be considered professional, but culturally there's a line drawn somewhere where it's like not considered professional, or not even that. Sometimes it's just a discomfort of yeah. not really wanting to stick out, not really wanting to explain words or phrases or whatever the hell else all the time at yeah. work, or having people like make it seem like the way you talk or the way you act is like so different. Mm-hmm. And so even if they're like, oh my God, that's so wonderful, like sometimes you just want to be like, you know, you just want to like do your thing and just keep going, you know, wanted to everything to be a thing all the right. time, you know. Yeah. So for me, code switching is that cultural switch where we switch off the cultural mannerisms, the speech, the tone, the sayings, the colloquialisms, or the vernacular that we're using under our cultural sort of like life. Mm-hmm. And we switch to what we call neutral, but what is really just white, because white people have made everything, you know, they've decided the stuff is neutral. What's really white is like, they're like, it's neutral. It's like, is it though? It's just kind of white.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what I guess, like to me, I suppose that's, you know, what code switching is. And yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. It resonates a lot with me, because I mean, I remember when we would be sitting in BTW, and for example, when Quincy was the AD, he was the AD while we were all working together, you know, we just hear him go, in his office, and then we'd all just like burst out laughing because that suck teat said so much. In like, it was just a sound. It's just an onomatopoeia, but it said so much in terms of, you know, maybe he had just, we hear him just slam down the phone out of a conversation he was having, or maybe you hear him clacking away and then he hisses his teeth, and it's like, it's so innate to, especially to Caribbean culture, and I'm sure to the African 100%. Culture as well.
Yeah, yeah. Because, it's, you know, one of those things from... I feel like just made it across the Middle Passage, like intact, and just did not, like, the meaning is the same, the sound is the same.
The word that we use to describe it is different, but we understand universally that it means disgust, it means... how dare this person?
Complete annoyance so and irritation and all of the above.
100%.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, and those are things that in another environment, people it just doesn't resonate in the same way. Like, I remember going to watch the new Spider-Man movie that just came out, and I felt I didn't feel like it had that much weight. Like, it had so much hype around it that I said, okay, I'm going to, like, I have my two vaccines, I'm going to go, this is the first time in 2 years, I'm going to go into the cinema, I'm going to experience it, you know, with the full cinema. And there was so much I wanted to suck my teeth at, but I was like, ain't nobody in this theater going to understand what that means. Like, they might just tell me to shut up or something like that. So I said, no. But I was really like, I don't really like this movie. And I didn't feel comfortable to just be because it was too, the movie wasn't all that it cracked up to be for me. It was just a lot of fan service and Zendaya for me was the highlight of that movie. And I'm like, okay, you need to make a Zendaya based Marvel movie where she gets superpowers or she's like the leader, because the rest of it I'm just like, meh. Yeah, okay. It's okay.
Yeah,
but I, totally. I, I,